You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Segment of our show, Susan Wilkie and Valerio Palladino will be sharing a little bit about their epilepsy work. So if you could introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about the society, that'd be great.
Susan, do you want me to start?
You start, sure.
Wonderful. Well, good day, everyone. My name is Valerio Palladino. I'm the executive director of the Edmonton Epilepsy Association. We are a registered charity with over 65 years of operation in the region, northern side of Alberta. In our province, we always have a geographical point of reference as Red Deer, as kind of the middle of the province town, signing the geographical entrance. So we kind of serve everybody north of that particular region. And again, we are a registered charity, and we support anybody impacted by a diagnosis of epilepsy. That includes individuals living with a condition, as well as their families and caregivers. And I'm introducing to you Susan Wilkie.
Hi, so my name is Susan. I'm currently the president of the Edmonton Epilepsy Association. I came to the association because my son, who is now 15, has epilepsy. He was diagnosed when he was 4, and that brought us to the association. So here we are.
So what sorts of programs and services does the association offer? It's interesting you mention about families impacted. Most people might just look at the patient, but how do you support those surrounding them?
Yes, I can probably answer to this question. Over the years, the 6.5 decades of operations, we have grown as a grassroots charity. And the beauty of this association is that it is made up of people deeply impacted by this neurological disease. Of course, a great deal of our programs are directed to supporting people with the disease. We are not a medical entity, of course, but we always like to tell the story that epilepsy, the diagnosis and the medical side of the condition, the anti-seizure medication, the surgical treatments, and all the other alternative treatments are definitely an essential part of managing seizures. But life, and that's one slice of the bigger pizza, that is the life of the person. And all the other slices, the social interaction, the support, the network, the community, are things that currently in our province are not addressed by anybody else. To name some of our key programs directly to people living with epilepsy, we know that living with seizures impacts memory and causes memory challenges either because of the seizures or the anti-seizure medication side effects. So we, about 5 years ago, started certifying our team of staff and volunteers to provide memory coaching support in a program called Hopscotch. We also connect trained volunteers with different walks in life with epilepsy with newer members that maybe have received a diagnosis recently. And we call that a mentorship program. And this is one of those programs, as we were saying, that doesn't only address folks who are directly impacted by epilepsy, but also their caregivers and family members. A new member registers for the program, provides a little bit of information about their profile, and let's say they are a brand new mother. I can actually speak to something that Susan is about to do this next Saturday. We just had a mother of a child with epilepsy who's been told that they're trying to reduce the anti-seizure medication on this young boy, and the mother has a lot of anxiety. So Susan, as a trained volunteer, will be pairing up as a new mentor with this new member and just offer a listening ear, experience, personal lived experience. And we know that sometimes even just knowing that a person is just one phone call away or an email away or a text away can really reduce that sense of anxiety. For the general public, we also offer a series of books. We are the only agency in North America that has a series of 11 titles of books professionally published, also available as audiobooks in French and in English, to explain epilepsy in lay terms. These are distributed all over Canada to clinics, offices, individuals, schools, emergency centers, EEG clinics, you name it. Additional programs include focused programs. For example, right now we're working on building mental health resources online with the collaboration and input of kids who are impacted by epilepsy and their families. And we are currently also working on delivering workshops for seniors. As we know, epilepsy tends to happen earlier before somebody turns 18 and after somebody is 65, even though it can happen at any age. And we try to focus on those different age constituencies as well. Susan, would you like to add a few more things?
One of the things, too, that we do offer is our Kids on the Block program. So it is a show with puppets that can go into the schools and do live. Now, I live in Northern Alberta, so we've actually been able to host that virtually at my child's school so that we can have the virtual performance with the puppets. And the puppets are a great opportunity. We have paid actors who voice the puppets and do the show, and it's a great opportunity for children to see epilepsy in a live setting and to understand more and have a safe space to ask their questions and learn more about epilepsy.
So
we also support individuals in new work spaces, or if they're a place where they've been working for a long time and the diagnosis of epilepsy happened a little later in life, to advocate for themselves, but also for the employers to understand how they can provide accommodations and be very supportive to an employee, whether they are new to the job or they've been doing whatever role for a long time. And we offer these epilepsy 101 sessions. As Susan was saying, we do it through webinars, hybrid or in person, always absolutely free of charge. And of course, we advocate and create awareness at every opportunity we can.
So in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning epilepsy?
All the time.
Susan, right? Yes, Susan.
All the time. So I can speak to just our lived experiences, but in our lived experiences, a lot of times with epilepsy, there are a lot of, there's a lot of stigma attached to that. A lot of people don't want to tell people they have seizures or don't want to tell people about their diagnosis. So the association really tries to, like, find unity in that and community in that. One myth for sure is that it's an invisible disease, really, right? It's an invisible one. Like my own child, we can see that he is perfectly safe to do so many things, but lots of people sometimes at the beginning feel scared to be around him. They're nervous of what might happen, when the reality is for him, his seizures are under control. So we're not worried about him having a seizure at this moment. We always live with a little bit of worry, but we wouldn't put him into situations that would be unsafe by any means. And it doesn't have to impact their cognitive levels. It doesn't have to impact their quality of life. My own child is very active in sports. Lots of times one of the myths for him is, oh, you can't do sports because you have epilepsy, but he is an avid skier. He plays hockey. He plays baseball. He's very active. And we keep him that way, that we keep him busy. So it has certainly not slowed him down in any capacity. We also feel very strongly that it doesn't define who he is, right? It's a part of who he is, but epilepsy does not define him, and there's nothing to be scared of in interacting with him. Those are just some of the more general myths that we, you know, live with in our day-to-day life, but I'm sure Valeria can speak to more of the broader epilepsy community within the association.
Absolutely. When we offer the Epilepsy 101 session, one key component of that seminar is teaching people how to provide first aid in case of convulsive seizures. And two myths that it's hard to believe they are still around in 2026 are, am I going to catch epilepsy if I catch this person because I need to move them on their side or provide some sort of comfort? And we always say, yes, it's a disease, but it's not it's a non-communicable disease. And then the other myth is that putting something in a person's mouth when they're having those convulsive seizures, right? I know personally, I come from a different country. When I was growing up, I had a friend who had tonic-clonic seizures, and I was taught over 35, 40 years ago that you have to put a spoon or a pen or something. And sometimes folks come to our session still with those questions. Oh, but aren't they going to swallow their tongue or anything like that? The other broader stigma associated with epilepsy, Susan has spoken to the children, so the development stages in life. On the other side, for people going to university or, again, working, yes, there are certain safety rules that, unfortunately, a person diagnosed with epilepsy would not be in a position to hold, such as professional driving or driving heavy machinery. But there are so many other things where very little and often non-expensive accommodation in, on the side of the employer can be implemented to empower the employer as a support element in that person's role of work and make the employee feel like they can actually contribute. So again, these are kind of some of the overall stigmas or myths associated when we start talking about epilepsy.
Right. Thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Coming up next in our show, I want to share with you a couple of on-location interviews I did at the recent ICHA Fishing Derby.
This is Dan Wells here with Callum the Big Nut from the Canadian Sport Fishing Show. And he's going to be telling me a little bit about being back at the ICHA Fishing Derby again this year. So what have you seen so far in terms of highlights?
I've seen a lot of smiling faces and happy people. We've got a beautiful day. It's probably 28 Celsius. We're at the 24th annual ICHA Fishing Derby. And it's nice to see all the people that we've seen here over the last 20 years. I think my wife and I have only missed about 2 years. One was a rainout, and one we couldn't be here. So it's nice to see all the volunteers that are helping them. It's nice to see all the people that have the booths, the food concessions, the Music Express, the big 50-piece band. And I know that they've got lots of prizes and gifts to hand out to people. So it's just wonderful that a lot of people that don't normally get out and enjoy fresh air and fishing while they're being supervised can enjoy a few hours today and just have a great time.
So do you find that events like these create that needed awareness for the disability community?
Definitely, yes. And I know there's lots of entities that are promoting it on social media, through radio and TV, and it's nice to see all the communities coming together from Windsor and even the surrounding areas. You know, there are people that are coming in from Detroit across the border.
Oh, I got a fish!
Yes, we've got a happy person here on the fish. There you go, you have to weigh it in. There's a fishing rod. Ah. So it's just nice that everybody's coming together, and I hope that more people will participate in the future. Realize that everybody is special. All of us are. We're made in God's image. And it's good to treat each other with love and care and just enjoy every day to the full.
Things I've noticed over the years is a certain peace aspect to being out on the water. So for someone, for example, with a mental health concern or just
to leave their worries elsewhere, at least for the few hours that they're here, and just enjoy some nice weather. So do you see yourself continuing to be a part of this? 100%, definitely. And we're encouraging people, even in different parts of Ontario, to kind of copy the ICHA model, you know, and to get communities and sponsors and to do their own events.
Thank you very much. This is Cam Wells here with
Gloria Connell.
She's going to be telling me a little bit about what brought her back to the ICHA fishing derby. So what brings you out to help out again?
Well, our very dear friend, Pat Pagano, who has since 2003 been the organizer in this wonderful event. I don't think he even actually formally asked me, but I was on board anyway. I was going to be here. That's how much I love this event.
So do you find that events like this create a needed awareness of the disability community?
Absolutely. This is a community that there are so many distractions. We are so busy with so many things that a lot of marginalized people will fall through the cracks. And this is an event that brings all of that to light. But more than that, it's because of all the different folks that volunteer their services as well. I love seeing community come together like that for such a worthy group of folks.
So you mentioned you've been doing this for some time. What are some of the high points for you?
Some of the high points, you're going to laugh, but I remember seeing a young fella pulling his rod out of the water, and there was this teeny tiny, looked like a little 2-inch, 3-inch fish on it, and the smile and the joy that exuded from that little boy's face. I love that, and so much so that my husband, who's kind of an amateur photographer now, he does photos as well for the event, so we're both here for the day, and he's taking pics of all these wonderful kids pulling these, you know, treasures out of the water. It's really a joy to watch.
So do you see yourself doing this event for years to come?
I really do. As long as Pat and my brother Nito are involved. Last night we did the volunteer dinner and we did a little music as well together, and that's a joy. Just a joy to be able to do something concrete. It's something I can do to help this cause. Thank you very much.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Valeria Palladino and Susan Wilkie told us a little bit about their epilepsy work. And we heard from Maria Connell and Italo Labignan, who were both in attendance at the recent ICHA Fishing Derby. In this segment of our show, Trish Barbato will be telling us a little bit about the Arthritis Society. So what can you tell me about the Arthritis Society?
Arthritis Society Canada is here to help the 6 million Canadians who are living with arthritis, of which there are over 100 different types. It's quite a serious disease, and often people are unclear as to what can be done or should be done. So we're here to help in many ways, support through our arthritis line. We have arthritis talks and education series. We have camps for kids who are diagnosed with arthritis and many other programs and services.
So how does the society reach out to those who could benefit from your work?
We do a lot of work with social media, as most organizations are doing now. We also have quite a large database of past donors, for example, or people who have interacted with support before. So that's a great group because we know that they're interested in arthritis. We can go back to them with anything that's new. I think it's hard to reach the kinds of numbers that we have with arthritis. Although we know that there are over 6 million Canadians living with arthritis, we think the number is much higher. Arthritis, if I think about osteoarthritis, we know that a third of those folks are diagnosed before the age of 45. And osteoarthritis is more like a midlife disease, because by the time you need a replacement, for example, a joint replacement, that's end-stage arthritis. That started a long time ago and has progressed. So we feel that there's many more people with arthritis who are undiagnosed.
So when you discuss final stage arthritis, do you have any advice for folks out there as to preventative steps they can take to sort of ease the impact?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that people do not know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about arthritis, but for example, over 99% of all knee replacements are due to arthritis. Over 80% of hip replacements are due to arthritis. So most joint replacements in this country are due to arthritis. Although people will say, oh, I have a bad knee or I have a bad shoulder. We know for a fact that there are lifestyle changes that can definitely improve the outcome. One thing, we have a great program in Ontario, for example, with physiotherapists, occupational therapists, social workers, and one of the things that the therapists say all the time is motion is lotion. So when you have arthritis, movement is really helpful. It helps get nutrients into the bone, into the joint. And so even though people with arthritis might feel sore, it's really important for them to keep moving. So that idea of getting exercise, getting movement into those joints, that's super important. Keeping weight down is essential. We know that obesity increases that risk of arthritis, but also can prolong the pain and the mobility issues and that sort of thing. So that is really important. Tobacco use is another one. Stop or significantly curtail. We know that also has an impact on the joint, the inflammation. So those are some of the things that people can do that is more within their control. And there are programs that can be helpful that are available in some parts of the country. And I'll give you one example. It's called GLAD, G-L-A-D. It was created in Denmark, and Canada has versions of this. So this is really good for people, particularly with knee osteoarthritis, which is very common, to help them, even if they're either waiting for a joint replacement or preparing for joint replacement. It can be very good to defer the surgery, or sometimes people take themselves off the surgery list. So it's very good evidence-based program that can be really helpful for folks.
So in your time with the Society, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Well, I think broadly for arthritis, when you think of the autoimmune diseases, so these are diseases like ankylosing spondylitis, rheumatoid arthritis, the ones that really require medication to help stop the destruction of the joint. Those types of arthritis, back when Arthritis Society Canada was started, it was started by a school teacher who would see children who had rheumatoid arthritis and their joints were in horrible, horrible shape and they couldn't go to school, and she was teaching them at their home. And she was just so outraged about this that she started the society and kind of single-handedly brought support and more input and funding and that sort of thing. And one of the real breakthrough there was biologics, so a drug that can actually help prevent the progress of that disease. We don't have that kind of drug for osteoarthritis, which is the most common type of arthritis, but for the autoimmune diseases, I would say that has been a massive, massive breakthrough that has really helped that type of arthritis. I think the other thing that, you know, we're really fortunate is that we can do joint replacements. I mean, I think about a time in history when that was kind of it. You couldn't move and, you know, that was sort of it. And we now have such great success with, for the most part, knees and hips, but other joint replacements are also getting better. So I think that those are all, kind of like exciting breakthroughs in arthritis. If I was to say, what am I looking forward to? I am really looking forward to, and I'm speaking personally as someone who has a lot of osteoarthritis in many, many joints, I would say a breakthrough in osteoarthritis. Right now, it's a lot of pain management, and wouldn't it be great if we had something that slowed or stopped or, hey, even reversed osteoarthritis?
So I'm curious, this teacher you mentioned who sort of founded the society, do you know what year she began teaching those kids in their homes?
Yeah, so she was a school teacher in the early 40s. And as you can imagine, if you don't have any, the pictures of these kids is just heartbreaking. And she became so outraged, she got a petition going out in British Columbia. And that petition went to the federal government. There's great stories of what she did. She would stand outside of the minister's office, and she didn't have an appointment, and they wouldn't let her see him, and she followed him into the bathroom to explain, this is an important issue, you have to do something. So she became quite fearless and quite obsessed about helping people with arthritis, and in fact helped fund not only our organization, but also the specialists that really help inform the autoimmune diseases, in particular rheumatologists. She also supported that as well, as with the physician community. So it's a great story of the power of one person and what they can do.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
My friends, something both Maria and Italo said during their interviews really spoke to me. It's about the idea of coming back and being of further and greater service to the disability community. For I've always maintained that you can't be around someone with a disability and not have your heart grow, not have your desire to be of support become something stronger. Truth is, we all need someone to rely on in our world, one time or another. And for someone with a disability, consistency is the watchword. Many of us in the disability population thrive on having familiar faces, people we know we can count on, people we know care about, our goals, our hopes, our dreams, and being a part of something gives disability population a chance to be out in the community and to say, we're part of the tapestry of your life. Be recognize it or not, folks with disabilities, they're in every community, every family, every walk of life. And bringing people together with disabilities and without is building a bridge. It's fostering understanding, community, and yes, even wisdom on both sides. But seeing the great passion that disability volunteers and servants have for this community never ceases to amaze me. It takes a strong heart and an open heart and a mind that's willing to say, the world isn't just one way or the other. Disability is many levels, is a beautiful tapestry of creativity, ability, and yes, community. And honestly, the more we come together and make our presence known in the community, the less it becomes a matter of, oh, disability doesn't affect me, it's not something I'm familiar with. Take a closer look. Folks with disabilities, they're all around, and they should be able to participate fully and richly in society. In any type of event, whether it be something large like the fishing derby, or just something small scale, something like being able to get out on a beach in a wheelchair and enjoying it, it's the perfect right of everyone to appreciate all that is around them. And the more we come together, the stronger the society we build. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started, so I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.